From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour goes back decades ago, in a time when Rochester could reasonably boast to having a Big Three. Kodak, Xerox, Bausch & Lomb. These companies grew to become industrial giants, employing tens of thousands. You know by now that Kodak alone employed roughly 65,000 people here in Greater Rochester at its peak. But these weren't simply industrial powerhouses. They were intellectual leaders, R&D, innovation, and there is a temptation to believe that the decline of the Big Three has corresponded to a decline in intellectual advancement. Inventions. On the contrary, though, the Democrat and Chronicle reports that patents are on the rise for local inventors, and the Rochester Intellectual Property Law Association, did you even know there was such a thing, is announcing its 40th Annual Inventor of the Year Award. So let's talk about the intellectual economy, about innovation, about inventions, and their place in Western New York. My guests for the hour include Sean Lehman, who is with the Democrat and Chronicle, has written so much about this, and he's going to help us understand what is going on. Sean, nice to have you in studio.
Thank you, Evan.
Also here is Steve Sasson, who probably by now is best known as the guy who invented the digital camera, and he gets a little sheepish about it, but I just want him to tell more stories for us because he's one of the best storytellers I know, and he's such an important part of what has happened at Kodak and Rochester over the decades. It's great to see you again, Steve.
Yeah, thank you, Evan.
And also here is Dominic Simonello, who is an IP attorney with Lee & Hayes and going to tell us about an event coming up next week, June 4th. That is next Thursday. What's going on, Dominic?
Oh, we have our annual Inventor of the Year Award ceremony that we're all very excited about.
And if people want to attend, they still can. Norma Holland is the MC, my old friend, and Bob Duffy, the president and CEO of the Rochester Business Alliance, offering the keynote. How can people get involved?
Sure. Well, the best way to get involved would be to visit our website, www.ripla.org. They can find the invitation form there that they can simply submit by email to our treasurer, Nick Gallo, or if they'd like to call in here at the studio, I'll be sure to leave my information here to the extent anyone needs to contact me about it.
All right, very good. Well, Steve Sasson, we go back to the 70s when your work that was the forerunner to what became a digital camera was going on. Mid-70s, right?
Yeah, I was working in the first digital camera in 1975.
And how much did you know about patent law and innovation and protecting your own invention at the time? Were you thinking about it?
No, almost none. You know, I was just a young 25-year-old engineer and the research laboratories at the apparatus division. And I had a chance to do some exploratory work with CCDs, which were very new at the time, and built this first, what we call now, a digital camera and playback system. But in terms of filing for patents, I really didn't know much about that at all. I had never really done anything like that. But by virtue of being at Eastman Kodak Company and in the research laboratory, there was a discipline to these kinds of things. And once they evaluated the idea, they thought this would be a very good patent. And one of my first demonstrations of the digital camera was to the patent staff at the Elmgrove plant. And so that's how I got introduced to the concept of it.
Did they tell you? You can't talk to people about this? Was there any sort of secrecy involved in that process?
Well, when you worked in a research laboratory at Kodak, and I think probably just about any institution that's doing a significant amount of R&D, you don't really speak publicly about this.
It goes without saying?
Yeah, that really goes without saying. So it wasn't particular to my particular project. In general, that was the case. If your project, as mine did, once we filed a patent, and it was granted in 1978, the patent for the first digital camera, there was some – that then it became a public announcement in such. So they there was some questions that came to the company, and I got them, and, of course, I sent them right to our public relations people, and they took care of it. I wasn't allowed to speak about it.
Was that the bulk of what you were working on in the mid to late 70s, or did you think, well, if this works out, fine, but I've got some other project? I mean, were you aware of just how significant that work was going to become?
There was a lot of discussion when I demonstrated the camera in 1975. I took pictures of people in conference rooms and showed it to them on a television set. And so I got asked a lot of questions I couldn't answer. And so it motivated me to try to find those answers. And I was personally motivated. I worked in digital imaging my entire career ever since that project. Starting in 1975, I worked in digital imaging exclusively at Kodak. And so it motivated me personally. But I was constantly challenged with the technical obstacles that were faced in the 70s and in the 80s. It wasn't until the late 1980s, 1989 or so, I think it became clear to me that digital photography was indeed going to happen.
I'm trying to remember our last conversation. You mentioned where you were at some U.S. landmark and you looked around. What was that story?
Oh, my Yellowstone
story. That's what it was.
It was. I was on vacation with my family, and my wife and I were waiting for. We were into Old Faithful. And if you've ever been to Old Faithful, there's a big clock there that tells you when the next eruption is going to take place. And there's a big viewing gallery, several benches that go around in a semicircle around it. So hundreds of people can gather, and they do, and they get ready for the next big event. And I was sitting there with my wife and Cindy, and I looked around, and I saw people getting their cameras already. And this was in the late, I'd say 98 or so, I think it was. And so there were beginning digital cameras, there were film cameras certainly, and there were hybrid cameras, still video floppy cameras, things like that. So all kinds of cameras were happening there. And I looked around and I said to my wife, it's happening. And then I told her for the first time, because it wasn't a normal topic of discussion in our household, but I did in 1975. I told her about the first camera that I built and that I thought that this might happen someday. I wasn't ever really sure when. I knew it was going to be like 20 years or something like that, but it was... But to actually see it sort of happen as you're on vacation, you're away from work and you just sort of see it happening there, that made a big impression on me. And that's why I remember that story.
One of my first jobs was at a place called Moto Photo.
Oh, yeah.
1 hour turnaround photo. And I remember the owner telling us, there will always be a need for what we do. You can't just take an image and have it instantly. We can give it to people in an hour. And that will always be valuable because people don't want to wait days. Now, this was certainly, I think, that the person who told me that would have been surprised if I could show him a cell phone that you could take a picture instantly and text it around the world. I think he would have probably seen the death notice for his business at that moment. Mm. What would you have thought, Steve, in 1975, 1978, 1989, to know that people are pulling out their cell phones and taking pictures the way they are? I mean, is there a part of you that does that hurt a little bit, or are you amazed? Are you inspired by it? How do you feel?
I'm amazed. I mean, who wouldn't be? I mean, to think about when I thought about this in the 70s, I thought if we could ever get to 2 million pixels, that would be absolute unbelievable, right?
See, I have no idea. Pixels, this is like a separate language for me, so I don't know what you mean by that. 2 million is a lot of pixels, I think. Right?
Yeah, 2 million is a lot of pixels. And typical cameras today, like your iPhone, has about 8 million pixels.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
I mean, so it's just incredible resolution and an incredible performance that goes along with that in terms of dynamic range and ability to capture good images, low noise, and that kind of thing. And then that got coupled in the early 2000s with the cell phone. The mobile phone. And so now capturing an image is one thing you do, but it's immediately accessible to anybody anywhere in the world, right? So this idea of being able to capture and then disseminate your information effortlessly was something that I never really thought too much about in the 70s. And in the certainly 80s, that was one of the advantages of digital photography is you could transmit it. But the ease with which you can do it now with a pocketable device that everybody has with them, I didn't really think much about that.
And now when we think about innovation and we think about intellectual property and all of the things that are happening now, I do think there is, to some degree, people looked at Kodak, Bausch & Lomb, Xerox. They looked at it as sort of a different heyday for the city. And there's maybe an assumption that everything's changed. We don't do that anymore. Are you in touch with that, Steve? Do you look around now? And I mean, are you kind of still following that kind of a scene? Are you interested in what's going on out there when it comes to new innovation locally?
Oh, yeah, I work a lot with local companies sometimes and local universities. And there's a tremendous amount going on. Yes, you're right. The major R&D institutions have become significantly smaller and more focused in their research. But that's opened up opportunities for many, many small companies and universities, startups around the region that are doing just amazing work here. And in fact, in the RIPLA event that we talked about earlier, when we considered, I was on the panel looking at some of the inventors that were nominated, they came from all over Rochester. Every company, Carestream, Kodak, Xerox, U of R, Gleason Works, all they, and that just sort of reflects on our community about how diverse the contributions are and where they come from.
We've got some questions coming in about patent wars and other things, and Dominic Simonello is going to help us understand some of the legal landscape as we go throughout the hour, because there is some interesting stuff going on out there. I want to make sure I ask Sean Lehman from the Democrat and Chronicle just to help sort of reset for us some of the reporting that you've been doing recently. Now, first of all, one of your headlines was more patents in 2014, local.
That's right.
But what does that mean? I mean, when people hear patent, are we talking about an invention? Are we talking about, give me a sense, first of all, more broadly speaking, what's going on?
Well, one of the interesting things that we've seen locally, particularly Xerox is a good example. We used to think of them as a copier company, a printer company. The research there has out in Webster has really broadened out into a number of different and cutting-edge fields. They're involved with smart camera systems. They're involved in healthcare technology, autonomous cars. And so we don't necessarily see products coming out of there in a retail environment or in our office that have the Xerox name on it. But they're coming up with these new technologies. They're inventing new things that have monetary value. I mean, one of the perfect example of how valuable intellectual property could be is Steve and I were talking about Ken Parolsky before we came in here. He was a Kodak engineer who came up with a system, what they call live image preview, which means you can see a live image in your camera while you're getting ready to take a picture. Kodak got over $1 billion in licensing revenue from that one patent. And even after Kodak got out of the digital camera business, you know, that's a technology that exists in every smartphone and every tablet and every digital camera, camcorder. So sometimes you don't necessarily know what that end game is going to be. And, you know, Steve's case is another good example. It was maybe 15 years after his work that the first digital SLR cameras came out, and another 10 years before we had consumer digital cameras. And I think that's the companies recognize that the work they're doing today isn't necessarily going to be something on the shelf in 6 months, which is different from the manufacturing economy. But all of the local companies, all of the top local companies are really focused on creating value by building their IP portfolio.
Are they investing in R&D the way they used to?
Well, you know, with Kodak, for example, Kodak is, if you look at that as a singular entity, obviously they're a lot smaller, but Kodak spun off. And so you have Carestream and Excellus and all of these other companies. I think in the aggregate, it's probably pretty comparable.
Steve, when you were doing what you were doing for Kodak, is there pressure when you are doing that an investment in an R&D isn't wasted? In other words, companies have to invest in R&D hoping for a return. And as Sean says, we could be talking about tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars. But a lot of R&D has to result in nothing, right? I mean, that's just sort of the inevitable, the trial and error, and failure has to be part of it, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you do have a lot of misses, okay? But R&D basically focuses on potential opportunities for the future. And so if you're in a big corporation, and it depends on when you're speaking about it. Now, in 1975, Kodak was a much bigger place, and their R&D budget was much bigger, and they had a much broader set of interests, okay? And so consequently, you would find there would be a lot of patents that are filed that may be a little bit far afield from what you typically would think Kodak would be interested in, okay? I think you'd find today that the research is more focused. They're definitely interested in certain markets and what they can do in those markets and what advantages they can accrue from innovating in those areas. And so I think Kodak is still doing innovative work, but I think it's focused now in material science and things like that around printing, which is their main business right now. And Xerox, the same thing. They're focusing a lot on business processes and things like that. So it's more focused, but they also realize that it's going to take a while for this stuff to turn into something realistic. Now, everybody hopes, let's be realistic, they hope it's fast, okay? Nobody gets too excited when you tell them it's going to be 15 years or so. But I still think that they're trying to form a basis for a competitive advantage at some point in the future.
Well, you talk about focused kind of research. Drones, Sean Lehman?
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. I spent some time out at RIT a couple months ago talking to folks in their drone lab there. This is a relatively new area, although we hear a lot about drones. But some of the, some of the things that they are doing just blow my mind. And they're, again, things that most people probably don't know about. One of the projects that the folks out there are working on for the agriculture field is essentially a small handheld device with a camera on it that a farmer can put up over his cornfield. And it goes out and it takes pictures of every individual plant in his cornfield. They can then run a computer analysis and figure out, if there's an irrigation problem in one part of the field, if there's an infestation of insects or something like that. So we're really in an exciting time in that field, and RIT is really one of the leaders, I think, worldwide in trying to find applications for this new technology.
What's your understanding of how competitive that is? It's got to be remarkably competitive.
I think it is remarkably competitive, and one of the ways that you can get a foothold there is by coming up with technologies that you can patent, and then that gives you an opportunity. You may not necessarily become the end user. You may not build anything, but you can license that to other companies who will.
You're hearing Sean Lehman from the Democrat and Chronicle, and Steve Sasson is a Kodak retiree and someone who is known, I think, best for now for inventing the digital camera. And when you hear about drones that are using aerial technology to take pictures of individual plants, assessing plant health, etc., that must, for someone like you, tied to digital imagery, that must be remarkable to you.
Oh, yes, it is. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. Just think of the technical issues that you have to solve to take pictures of individual plants from a moving platform that's probably only 2 feet across and then get those images down and then organize the images. It's just incredible amount of work that's been going on. But the platforms are coming fast and furious, and the young people at our local universities are taking advantage of all of these tools to do some really innovative and progressive things with them, much like the story that Sean just told you. That's really useful to a small farmer. That's something that he couldn't do before. And that's what invention's all about.
And Dominic Simonello from Lee and Hayes, forgive my ignorance on this, but let me just start on the question of drones. Let's say someone is developing technology when it comes to drones. How do you know that what you're doing, because it is so competitive, mm-hmm. is unique into and of itself, that there isn't sort of a patent underworks that is somewhat similar or very similar somewhere else in this country, somewhere else in this world?
Sure, that's a great question. And Sean, you bring up a great point. I mean, some of the things you talked about are right on the money in terms of talking about we want to help companies and help small businesses invent things that are patentable so that they can therefore derive value from those assets, those patent assets, if you will, however they choose to do it. And it really is an interesting dilemma for a lot of small companies, understanding what the intellectual property landscape is, whether it's in terms of trademark or patent or any type of IP that you're using to protect what you're working on. But you're right. It's very important to get an understanding for what is the patent landscape, what does it look like, which assets are already out there owned by various entities that might stop us from doing what we want to do from a technological standpoint. So to answer your question, Evan, a lot of companies will come to us very early on in the process with that idea in mind. They'll have a sense for where they want to go with their technology. They'll recognize, for example, a problem in the marketplace that they're trying to solve and perhaps commercialize. But before they do that, they'll do their diligence and think about, okay, if we go down this road, are we going to be getting ourselves into a whole heap of trouble from a patent standpoint? Are we potentially going to infringe someone else's existing patent? So that analysis at a very early stage is very important for a lot of companies to do. There are a lot of different ways of doing it. The most common way is to have a search performed. So in other words, we'll search for patents that are in existence, that are enforceable, and that are owned typically by these companies' competitors, just to get a sense for, okay, what does the landscape look like? Are there any patent claims out there that we might be in danger of infringing should we move forward with this particular technology? And that's really an analysis that has to be done at the early stages. but it can pave the way oftentimes for at least an understanding of where to go with the R&D efforts.
Now, Steve Sasson, I know Kodak's never been involved in a patent dispute. It's been a nice, happy history. But seriously, when you're working on the digital camera throughout the 70s and the 80s, are you concerned at any point that somebody else somewhere is going to roll out something, either sort of getting out ahead of you or eventually building on work that you're doing that you feel is maybe sort of unfairly borrowing, et cetera? Do those things go through your mind in R&D?
Well, it depends on where you were. In my career, I spent the last 5 years involved with licensing and litigation, testified for a number of cases at Kodak. So I was involved very heavily in the patent litigation side of things. In the early part of my career, I hardly knew what a patent was. So I've been through this whole transition. I must tell you, in the early stages of any technology, of course, it's a little bit like the Wild West. You know, you're trying ideas. People get you're anxious to learn about what other people are doing. I mean, just to see where they're going with this. Then as the market starts to develop, and in the case of digital photography, that took decades, today markets develop faster. So I think these comments are relative to that time frame. But as the market starts to develop, then, of course, you get more defensive. And you should be very careful not to do any public announcement of your invention until you file, especially now with the new regulations. Because somebody can take that and use that as a way to get around your patent or to invalidate your patent. So it's depending upon the time frame and the duration of the technology that's being developed and how fast the market it's going to apply to is being developed, you're either happy to see other people working in the area or not so happy.
We're going to be talking about how to get a patent and how things have changed. The 2013 America Invents Act has changed the landscape quite a bit. And so in our second half hour, we're going to get into that, some of the other patent wars. We're going to answer some of your questions that have been coming in online. But before we do that, we'll remind you that next Thursday, June 4th at 3:30 p.m. is the Inventor of the Year Awards 40th Annual. And Dominic Simonello, if people want tickets, what can they do to get involved with the ceremony?
Sure. Well, I would encourage anyone who's interested in attending to call in here to the station. I'll certainly leave my email address and contact information here, but that information is Dominic, DominicC, so DominicC at LeeHayes.com. They can certainly email me and be more than happy to put them in touch with folks who will be collecting their money.
their money, their awards.
And their registration form.
I'm looking down the list, and I don't know how much we can give away in our second half hour at some of the list, but there is, it does, as Sean Lehman's been reporting, there is more going on than I think we probably realize. A lot happening under our noses still when it comes to invention in Western New York. Short break, and we're going to come back and answer some of your listeners' questions as we wade through the questions of innovation, invention, and where we are in Rochester in 2015. Maybe we don't need to be so down on that when we think about the change in technologies, change in the economy. And it's not the big three anymore, but doesn't mean we're not inventing things. We're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Wednesday on the next Connections. You might have heard recently that Henrietta supervisor Jack Moore decided to undergo sensitivity training. What does that really mean, though? We'll sit down with folks whose job it is to teach sensitivity training, and they'll tell us about what anti-racism training is and what it takes for someone to truly change. Join that conversation Wednesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
Welcome back to Connections. First question from a listener, and I'll kick it to the attorney on the panel. Dominic Simonello is here from Lee and Hayes. I don't know how much he can weigh in on this, but we're going to try. So here it is. The first question is, I hope your guests can share some thoughts about the patent wars going on with Apple, Samsung, and Google in particular over design patents as trivial as icons wiggling as a sign they can be deleted. That and other predatory companies that snap up every patent they can find and then sue real innovators for royalties over utterly insignificant features. Dominic.
Sure. You know, that's an interesting question, and I think I would actually bifurcate the question into two individual questions. One, I think the first deals with, hey, why are these folks able to get protection for what seems like some pretty minuscule inventions in their design patents in particular? And the second is these other entities, which are typically referred to as non-practicing entities that, in essence, purchase patents and then turn around and sue other folks for infringing those patents that they now own but aren't actually practicing. We'll take the first one first, I guess, with regard to the design patent mm-hmm. stuff. It may seem trivial, but I'd argue that I think it depends on your perspective. Certainly, for from the perspective of Apple and Samsung, the ability to obtain protection for designs, which is not a new thing, design patents have been around for a long, long time, and have been litigated numerous times over the years, and they are a valid way of protecting some of your intellectual property. And I would liken it to, in many ways, they share a lot of similarity with trademark protection for something very similar. So these are very valuable assets for a lot of companies. Again, it depends on your perspective, and it depends on the product that you're trying to market and commercialize. But these things are bearing themselves out in the courts, at least with respect to Apple and Samsung, for very high dollar amounts. And so these are not trivial things, certainly. They're things that these companies have invested a great deal of money and effort in into designing, and it's a substantial part of their patent portfolio. So these are, as important sometimes as trademarks or as utility patents.
So, for example, in the earlier days of the internet, when we would see an hourglass come up to tell us to wait, we might think, well, that's just a silly little feature. But if you created that and you want to communicate with your possible commercial audience and that this is an important little feature, it's something that you might go to war in court over to protect.
Sure, that's right. To the extent that another company is using something that is similar so as to, potentially cause confusion as to who owns that particular mm-hmm. thing, that might be something that you'd want to assert, certainly from a patent perspective. It may seem minuscule and trivial, but certainly when we're referring to things like the iPhone, the numbers are pretty dramatic in scale.
Yeah, I would say so. Steve Sasson?
Just a comment here. I agree with everything that Dominic said. I can't comment in specific about the Apple and Samsung because I actually work on those cases. But sometimes you choose a patent for strategic reasons. And if you're going to court and you're dealing with patents and you're dealing with a jury, sometimes an easy-to-understand patent, if it's a clear win, is worth something. And so sometimes you choose patents based on litigation strategy rather than significance.
Give me an example of what is an easy-to-understand patent. Well,
you just cited one about the hourglass, okay. For example. Everybody understands what that is. If I were to go into court and ask about some esoteric algorithm that was leveraging some other mathematical construct, it would be very hard to get that across to a jury. But an icon that switches with an hourglass, everybody sees that and knows what that is, and so it's easy to understand. So if you've got a clear win, now these cases are big cases, and so they involve a lot of money and a lot of powerful attorneys and things like that, and they're out for a strategic win, I think, sometimes. So.
Well, and here's a follow-up question along the same lines, and maybe Steve and Dominic can hit on this. You mentioned earlier a live preview picture. Is that innovation or patent abuse for something that's obvious but can go towards royalties, et cetera? So a live picture, a preview picture on a digital camera seems like a component that whoever is creating that camera would need. Then the question becomes, can you go to court and say, wait a second, that's our innovation, that's our patent. Dominic?
Well, I think we need to take a step back first, just to understand what is actually being protected by the patents themselves. So while it may seem trivial that just having a preview window on your iPhone popping up and showing, a picture in advance of you displaying it on the screen may seem obvious to the end user. But the reality is a company's ability to protect the technology that's used to affect the display of that preview window can be extraordinarily complicated and can be the result of many years and many thousands and thousands of dollars of research into actually being able to developed the technology that enables the iPhone to do that, or any other phone. So, again, 10,000 foot view is that the patents that we're really talking about here are protecting some pretty serious advancements in the technology themselves. And so those, I don't think, should be taken very lightly. Would you agree with that, Steve?
Yeah, I do. I think there's a lot of work there. In the case of Perolsky's patent, I worked on that case for Kodak and worked very closely with Ken on that. And that's a really good patent because it not only suggests a relatively simple concept. It's simple now because we all use it and see it. It wasn't so simple back then, okay? But also in that patent was specifically how we implemented it and how we used the technology at the time. And specific implementation details were put in there. So he described a working thing that actually added value to a camera. And so that had value, and it turned out to have enormous value in terms of how everybody was using it. So,
and another thing to consider in terms of obtaining protection for inventions like that is that there really has been a shift in the pendulum, and this shift occurred 7 or 8 years ago with the advent of some Supreme Court cases. But one of the things that has resulted is that it has become very difficult, at least from a patent attorney's perspective, to obtain patent protection for inventions that could be deemed what some people might say as being obvious. So if an invention is simply a new combination of things that have already existed in the past, a long time ago, those types of inventions used to be easier to protect. But what this created was an environment that causes the questions like some of the questions that we've received, and that is, hey, this patent is junk, right? This how could you possibly get a patent on this? This is so obvious. This patent must not be worth anything, or it can't certainly be enforceable. The courts have tried to put up walls that have really made and it really increased the barrier to obtaining protection for those types of inventions that are ostensibly obvious. And so I agree with the callers who say, well, geez, isn't this an obvious thing to do? If we have too many patents like that, that weakens our patent system and is a very, very bad thing, I think, certainly for our economy as a whole. We don't want a situation where we're issuing a lot of obvious or very troublesome, poor patents that maybe shouldn't be issued. We want a strong patent system. And the courts have tried to right the ship, if you will, with some recent court cases.
All right, so the courts have, but we also saw the president sign in the 2013 America Invents Act. And the difference between first to file and first to invent, is that the terminology,
right,
Dominic? But help us understand what the difference between first to file and first to invent.
Sure, absolutely. That's one of the many different things that was included in the America Invents Act, or the AIA. For many years, since our forefathers first wrote about intellectual property rights as being part of the Constitution, we were a little bit different than just about every other country out there, in that our system was designed to be a first-to-invent system. And what that means is, if you're an inventor, no matter how large or how small you are, if you can establish and prove that you, in fact, were the first entity or person or persons to invent this particular thing, you should have priority over anyone else who comes to the patent office later and files their patent application for the same invention or one that's arguably similar. And that carried on for a long, long time, up until the AIA. The AIA has changed that paradigm and aligned the United States with the rest of the world, in that we are now a first-to-file system. So whereas before, for instance, inventor A could have argued that, hey, I invented this before inventor B, I should have rights to this protection in form of a patent. Now, that argument has gone away. Instead, the only evaluation point is who filed their patent application first. It's the priority goes to the entity that has the earliest priority date, which is most commonly the filing date of that patent application at the patent office.
What does this effectively change?
I think it's changed. Certainly, it's the onus, I think, is on realistically, I think the onus is on the patent attorney. I think the onus is on the patent attorney to try and, once the client has come to them and described the invention, the onus is on the attorney to get the application written in a reasonable period of time, as quickly as they can, and get the application on file as soon as they can. I think some could and have argued that this first-to-file paradigm has shifted the has given an advantage, perhaps, to larger companies versus smaller companies or maybe even solo inventors, because larger companies typically have the resources to get those applications on file quicker. There have been studies, and I think the Patent Office website actually has some information on this, that there doesn't seem to have been as dramatic of a disadvantage to smaller companies, at least as of yet, when they've examined the profiles of the applicants that they've received since the AIA was enacted. But certainly I can understand that as being a concern.
Question for Sean Lehman with the Democrat and Chronicle comes from a listener named Mark who wants to know. He says, Rochester used to be known for the big three that you've been talking about. What is our regional identity now? And maybe in regards to innovation. So as we mentioned earlier, Sean Lehman's been reporting for the Democrat and Chronicle about sort of the intellectual economy. And it's an interesting question from Mark. What do you think, Sean?
Well, Kodak and Xerox are still by far the two biggest research labs here in town, both in terms of the number of employees, but also in terms of the number of patents that they churn out. Xerox ranks each year somewhere between 10th and 15th among U.S. companies overall. So they're really one of the giants. The places that we're seeing the most new IP generated, a lot of those are Kodak spinoff companies like Carestream, which had, 75 patents last year. Excellus, the aerospace company, Ortho Clinical Diagnostics. All of these former Kodak companies which have spun off are still very heavily invested in research. The two entities that we're seeing that are really rising up through the ranks are the University of Rochester and RIT, as the intellectual property has become an important part of what they're doing there. In addition to the educational work, IP can be a source of significant revenue for the universities and can help fund some of these programs that they want to create.
As Sean mentioned earlier in the hour and has been writing about, one, I think, small but I think significant, interesting example that he's written about is drones at RIT. And on the question of what is coming, what's next, I doubt 20 years ago we would have been thinking about drones. But that's part of what sort of being forward-thinking is all about when it comes to figuring out what is next and what's needed. So here's a question from Tim, and I want to direct it to Steve Sasson. Kodak retiree and inventor of the digital camera. Tim says, it's hard to imagine it getting better than the quality of the picture quality on new phones, for example. What can be improved upon at all anymore as far as that goes? So, Steve, have we reached the pinnacle of photographic innovation?
I hate that question.
Why do you hate that question?
Well, because, people, I don't know. I mean, you take a look at the ability to capture wonderful images inexpensively, conveniently, reliably is with us, right? Everybody can do that. I still think there's challenges that remain in terms of conventional photography. We're generating more images than ever before, so finding the images, right? Categorizing these images so that they're readily accessible, right? And then, of course, the question can be asked, if there's so many images being taken every day, do you even need a camera? Maybe the idea is, if you want a picture, just go look one up. There's one that's been taken of it, right? I mean, you're getting to that point almost, right? So the taking part of it is challenging. But I think the storage, the retrieval, the categorization of the image is still a challenge. Authenticity of images. What exactly is the image that you took? And there's so much ability to manipulate images for all kinds of reasons, to make it look better, to make it easier to transmit. And then what was that original image that you captured, kind of thing. So archivists and people in museums are worried about that kind of stuff. Mm. So there's many questions that still remain, but the ability to capture an image is what I think was the basis of the question you asked, more or less has been solved. At least I can't imagine it being any easier. Of course, maybe we'll build cameras into our eyeglasses and we just have to think about
taking
a picture.
Yeah, you hear about that.
Yeah,
who knows?
And then Google Glass and all that kind of stuff.
But do you worry about image falsification, or at least how easy it is to manipulate images, which can be great, but can also be concerning?
There's a lot of issues with that. I mean, let's face it. What reliably is an image? You know, magazines and periodicals and people who use images to tell a story, you want to make sure the story is correctly told. So the ability to manipulate those images has to be very strictly controlled. And then, of course, when you use images for any kind of legal evidentiary things, the chain of custody has to be maintained. What is the actual image that you're referring to, and was it manipulated at any point in its life? So these are all different. Depending on how you're using the image, it can be quite an issue.
When it comes to patents, then, let me ask Dominic Simonello, then, the attorney on the panel, the question that some of our listeners, I've gotten a number of emails and comments on Twitter from people who are pointing out we're talking about big companies, big universities, intellectual property. But several people have said, but what about me? I've got a cool idea. I'd like a patent. I imagine patent work happens for people across the spectrum.
Of course.
And so take us through the process. Someone's got an idea. Someone has, I have no idea what it's for, but whatever it is, and they want to think about a patent. They want to protect it. What do you do? What's the process?
Sure. I guess the first thing to note is that as an inventor, you yourself can file your own patent application with the patent office. You don't necessarily need to go to a patent attorney, which can be fairly expensive depending on what's involved.
This is an attorney saying this. This is fascinating.
I know.
This is fascinating. Go ahead.
Is there a delay? Can we maybe retract that? But the process, if you will, is more often than not, regardless of whether you're a large company or a small company, you'll want a patent attorney to assist you with this, because it can be very tricky to write a patent application and get it on file in the appropriate way. And so, but the process is actually relatively straightforward for the inventor. What will typically happen is the inventor will visit with a patent attorney and describe the invention in as much detail as they can. And certainly Steve can ascribe to this. But at that point, the patent attorney really has to immerse him or herself in the technology well enough to understand what the invention is, because that attorney will be tasked with writing about that invention. They'll prepare the application, which is basically has a couple different parts, but essentially it includes a long written description of a bunch of different embodiments of variations on what the invention can include. It'll also include a series of figures that the written description will actually describe. And then at the very tail end of the application, there will be a list of very lengthy and poorly written and hard to understand sentences called the claims. And those claims, while they may be hard to understand and lengthy, those claims are actually the most important part of your application, because the claims are those sentences which describe exactly what it is that you're trying to protect. So you can think of them as the claims are the words and sentences that form your fence, if you will. They fence in the area of technology that particular patent is going to protect. So a lot of attention goes into crafting the claims properly in order to be as broad as possible, create the biggest fence we can, while at the same time being narrow enough to avoid any of the other patents that are already out there that could block us from getting protection.
Steve?
I just want to add one thing. Dominic probably would comment on this, and that is that you have the ability to file what's called a provisional patent, which sometimes is easier to do, and it's less costly to do, and it's sort of like it's a holding action. It preserves your place in line for a year with your idea. And sometimes new inventors or inventors that don't have a lot of capital will do that first, to allow them to get the position and start thinking about the details of the claims over the next year.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Provisional application practice has actually become more important with the advent of the AIA first to file, because what I mean by that is a lot of times you'll get these smaller companies or even larger companies who just aren't quite sure if there's going to be a viable market for this product, and they're not sure if they're going to be able to commercialize it or obtain or get some licensing partners for that IP. So what they'll do is file a provisional application, which is typically a more bare bones application that can be filed relatively quickly to get your priority date for purposes of patenting.
We're talking about invention and intellectual property with our panel, Dominic Simonello, an attorney for Lee & Hayes, Sean Lehman, a reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle, Steve Sasson, an electrical engineer, inventor of the digital camera, and the recipient of the 2009 Distinguished Inventor of the Year Award, and that comes from the Rochester Intellectual Property Law Association. Their awards for 2015 are next week, next Thursday the 4th, and tickets still available. And if you want to go out and attend, and if you read the list of the people who have won these awards in the past, maybe the people's names aren't household names, but a lot of what they do is just so interesting to see. And I don't know how much you're allowed to tell us, Dominic, about what is going to be happening next week, but can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the process of trying to decide who is the inventor of the year for our region?
Sure, of course. And Steve can actually speak very well to this, as he's on the panel of this year's selection committee. So, but broadly, what the organization has done is we will request from the membership those who would like to volunteer to be on the selection committee. And so we'll get a committee of volunteers from the Rochester IP Law Association who would like to be involved in this process. We'll then send out a request for nominations to our membership. And at that point, it's basically casting a nicely sized net, if you will, of inventors in the area who've really made a contribution to a particular technology, and getting those nominations in a timely manner. We then send the nominations to the committee for evaluation, and they decide in their infinite wisdom who should win the award. Isn't that right?
And it's a tough decision, let me tell you, because the nominations, at least for this year, were just all fantastic.
Yeah,
I mean,
they
were
really,
very significant,
really great this year.
And they covered all different technologies. And it goes to the premise of why we're having this show, is that Rochester is a very inventive community across a whole bunch of technologies, world-class stuff, that at some point many of these inventions are going to affect people's lives around the world. And they started here in Rochester.
Can you tell us about some of what's on that list?
Well, I don't want to go into too much detail on individual inventors and stuff like that. Let me just tell you, it covered everything from heavy iron type of stuff with machining all the way to biosciences and algorithms to help identify diseases and things. And it came from, what I liked about it is it came from all these different companies in Rochester. You know, that was really fun to see that, you know, and it really, it just, it's a confirmation that this community is inventing today just as much as it was doing before, and it's going to have an impact on the world.
I guess a little more spread out. Again, as Sean Lehman said, you certainly still see Kodak and some of the others, but Sean, you know, when we think about the various forms of industry locally, maybe a little bit of a less of a big three and more of a broader-based community is part of the future, and that's okay, I think.
I think that's a good thing, actually, to not have our fortunes tied to a single company or to a single product. The way that Kodak was tied to film for so long and Xerox was, you know, a copier company, I think the diversity of the work that's being done here, not just in terms of companies, but in terms of thought leaders, as Steve says, I think that's what's really most encouraging.
You agree, Steve?
Yeah, I do. I think it's just fantastic.
Even a Kodak retiree like you agrees with that.
Yeah. I do. I think, you know, there are advantages to big companies and there's disadvantages to big companies. And I think by seeing all of this new innovation taking place in small companies, at the universities and things like that, you have a lot of ideas percolating up. And there's easy ways to get funding sometimes for this. There's easy ways to do early intellectual property research. And people are generating lots of new ideas, and the idea itself is now propelling it forward. Whereas sometimes in big companies, you have to go through sort of committees, you know, and there's a formal decision structure that sometimes weeds out good ideas.
Can I start to wrap with a really dumb question? I mean, I'm filled with them. When you host a talk show, it's de rigueur to ask all kinds of silly questions. But a patent comes in a... Does it come in an actual form when you get a patent, Dominic? Do you get an actual, it's like a certificate, like, you know, you graduated second grade or whatever it was, all the things you
That's
get?
That's right. Yeah, you actually receive an actual patent.
All right, an actual patent. So, Steve Sasson, do you still have yours from back in back in the Kodak day,
yes,
the digital camera?
I keep copies of all the patents. Most inventors do. You keep a copy of the patent that's issued by the U.S. Patent Office.
And so that original patent's kicking around somewhere that you have?
Yeah, I mean, it's a copy of it. You know, the original one goes to the company. They own the patent. It's usually the case in that case. But I have a copy of all those, and most of the inventors I know keep a little file with all their patents in it.
Any sentimental meaning for something like that for you? Yeah.
It's fun to look at it sometimes, especially the drawings.
Just remember everything that you went into it?
No.
If you want to attend next week, it is next Thursday, hosted by the great Norma Holland, with Bob Duffy from RBA providing the keynote for the Rochester Intellectual Property Law Association. Again, I started the hour saying, did you even know there was such a thing? And there is such a thing. They've been doing this for 40 years. The Distinguished Inventor of the Year Award, Dominic Simonello from Lee & Hayes, is going to be there, part of the Intellectual Property Law Association. So some final thoughts, just 30 seconds or so. What is the Intellectual Property Law Association?
A not-for-profit organization that has been put into place to foster recognition, I think, for our local area inventors. And we do that by hosting a number of events each year, the Inventor of the Year Award Ceremony being one of them. We also host frequent luncheons and other day-long educational events throughout the year where we invite speakers in to talk on topics related to intellectual property and things like that.
Yeah. Steve Sasson, you're an optimist that this community keeps inventing, even though we've seen so much change. You seem to be
optimist. That's what inventing is all about, is about change, right, and creating new opportunities, and that's what Rochester's doing.
Well, congratulations on the work that you have always done, Stephen. Keep doing, and thank you for taking the time to come in. We always appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
Sean Lehman from the Democrat and Chronicle, nice to talk to you, Sean.
As always, Evan.
And Dominic Simonello, thanks so much for your expertise on patent law and all of the things that are happening in our community.
Thank you for having me.
A community of inventors, as we find out this hour that we're still doing that. Thanks for listening to Connections these 2 hours today on this Tuesday afternoon, and we'll talk to you Wednesday right here on member-supported public radio.